Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
I'm Scott Wapner, and you're listening to CNBC's Halftime Report, the podcast, the most profitable hour of the trading day. We record this live weekdays at 12 Eastern. Listen in.
Carl, thanks. Welcome to the Halftime Report. I'm Scott Wapner, front and center this hour, the state of stocks, the Dow hitting another new record high today. The Nasdaq, though, continuing its losing streak. Where is your money heading in the months ahead? That's the big question, the big debate as well on this program. And we'll do that with the investment committee. Joining me for the hour today, Courtney Gibson is the president of Loop Capital Markets. Rob Seachin, the co-founder and managing partner of New Edge Capital Group. Josh Brown, John Ajarian. Good to see everybody. Let's go to the wall. I'll show you that new record high for the Dow today. Highs of the day, too. Better than 170 for the Dow. 34,402. S&P, not that far away from its own high, about 40 points, give or take. NASDAQ, as I said, that losing streak, it's going on. The longest one since October. It's on pace for the worst week in a couple of months. Was just trying to get positive. It's dipped negative by about 5 points. Josh Brown, start with you. What's going on? What's happening within the markets here, do you think?
I think that market participants are starting to anticipate the idea of an economy that is supported by its own inherent growth engines and not reliant on Federal Reserve stimulus as far as the eye can see. I do think we're getting closer to the moment where the Fed's going to have to make an offhanded remark about tapering asset purchases, which I think would be appropriate. Unfortunately, there's no great way to come out and say it. During the last taper tantrum in 2013, Bernanke kind of snuck it in there during congressional testimony, not during a Fed meeting. The market freaked out, and it was really the highest multiple growth stocks that got hit the hardest. And that's exactly what's going to happen this time. And I think market participants are sort of starting to sniff that out. So treasuries have bottomed recently. Gold has bottomed recently. The yen has bottomed recently. These are all risk-off trades. You do have this momentum in financials and cyclicals. I think that should hold up okay. But the growth stocks, the things that are most susceptible to a tapering of asset purchases and then a subsequent eventual rise in rates are really the epicenter of the damage. I was looking at the ARK ETFs, Judge. Nothing to do with like ARK, like they're not doing a good job, ARK the company, but just that kind of that theme. Mm-hmm. Right. That idea of who cares about cash flow? Let's just buy user growth or whatever. The flagship ARK fund is down 29% from its high. Yeah. That's a massive drawdown.
More. And of
course,
more
you know,
now,
most of the money came in at the top.
I don't know if you have a monitor, yeah. You know, our air where you're sitting and the way you're looking at things, but we're showing it on the screen right now. It's down 32.3% off of its year high. Your point is well taken. So what you're essentially saying, Josh, is the market's walking itself up to a taper tantrum of some kind.
Yeah, it's going to happen, and it won't be very different from last year. But I think it's healthy. It should happen. I'd rather do it sooner than later. If you just really quickly, if you go back and look at what that was like for investors, May and June were pretty disastrous for stocks. Rates spiked. But then by July, they were already like reassuring us and walking things back, and the markets were able to stabilize. They did that 7 months in advance of the actual start of tapering, which was officially announced December of that year of 2013. They spent all of 2014 gradually buying less assets each month, and then you didn't get the first rate hike until December of 14. Mm-hmm. So almost 20 months of prepping markets for that first rate hike. Like, I feel like that process probably has to start this summer. If you keep getting blowout employment numbers and job openings skyrocket and housing activity exceeding any other calendar year outside of 2006, if this is what the pace of the real economy is, and we think it's somewhat sustainable, it's not appropriate to buy $40 billion worth of mortgage bonds and $80 billion worth of treasuries every month without end. It makes no sense.
That's exactly what Rick Rieder has told us within the last couple of weeks.
Well, Rick is smart.
Yeah. Court, you know, I have this viewer question in front of me that came in a few moments ago, and I think it's a good one because I think a lot of people are asking themselves this or want advice from people like you. When the 10-year was rising, says Kelly from Columbus, Ohio, tech was systematically tanking, right? We saw that and we talked about it every day. As yields have lowered and stabilized, which they are lower again today, I think 158, something like that, tech is still dropping. So if higher yields were causing tech to sell off, why are lower yields causing tech to continue to sell off?
Well, great to see you guys today, of course. You know, and I think it's a really interesting question. And I think in theory of economics, right, and what we know about how yields should impact growth stocks, the way that it reacted initially is what you would expect. What you're seeing now, you'd say, why in the world is this happening? And that's what the viewer is saying. You have to look beyond the surface of kind of how yields are impacting, because that's not the only thing that impacts these growth stocks, these large tech names. When you think about raising cash or when large institutions need to get liquidity, where are they going to go? They're going to go to the most liquid stocks. And that's what you see in these big mega cap names. And so every time they need to raise cash to do something else, if they want to rebalance, if they want to do anything, they're pulling it from Apple, they're pulling it from Facebook. Those names have a disproportionate weight in an overwhelming majority of portfolios. And so when it comes time for liquidity needs, that's where investors are going. And so I personally, as you know, Scott, am a heavy believer in tech, especially some of those big mega cap tech names that are well positioned in this marketplace for the future. Unfortunately, in the short term, whenever you see, again, like a Facebook provide knockout earnings, you're going to see people take money off the table. Same thing for Apple. And so, yields are impacting growth stocks to a certain extent, as they should potentially. And that's a debate in and of itself that, we can have one day. But ultimately, it's not just yields and what's happening with the 10-year that's causing some of the turmoil that you're seeing in the stock market, particularly around those mega cap growth names.
Well, obviously, people, if they're moving out of equities and they're concerned about where things may be, I don't know, maybe they're going into Bitcoin and they're going into bonds as a safety play. Doc, you've been looking for the correction that Josh Brown says the market is sniffing around right now, whether it's the earliest stages of what may be a taper tantrum or what have you. Is this the correction that you've been looking for?
Yeah, I think this is part of it, Scott. And I'm not so much disagreeing with Josh, but I think Josh and Courtney both made some great points here. And one of those is that Josh said, for instance, that when the taper tantrum happens, those stocks, those mega cap growth stocks, are going to be the ones hit hardest. I disagree there, Josh, because that's already happening. They're anticipating it this time much more
than what we say, Bernanke leaking.
Well, no. So I'm saying when it comes out, that's when they don't. I think that's the buy rumor, sell news in reverse. In other words, I think they're reacting to it
I think they're getting ahead of it.
Yeah. I do. I agree with you. But I think what's going to happen, Scott and Josh, is that we're going to see people reacting. I mean, the reason that, virtually every earnings on the tech side has been sold, virtually all of them. You've got an exception here and there. But even, whether it's Amazon popping to 3,600 and then flat on the day immediately after that, or whether it's Apple up 2 or 3% and then down on the day, all of that stuff is happening because people are using these times as exit points, just as Courtney said, also drawing funds from those areas. I think when we finally get to the point, Josh, where they do the taper tantrum-ish thing again, that these stocks will have already anticipated it by what we're seeing right now. You cited the ARK fund down 29 or 30%. And obviously that's accurate. And I think that's a sign that people have already started their exit from those big stocks and from those stocks without earnings, as you say, you know, whether it's the Zooms of the world or whether it's the Teladocs and all the rest. And all of those are in Kathy's portfolio. I think they're ahead of themselves. And I think after we get to that point, then those stocks will actually then bottom out and start picking up again while the rest of the market reacts to that taper tantrum.
John, let me just say really quickly, I know we want to get to Rob.
Please, go ahead.
He looks like $1 million right now, by the way. Let me just respond to that. I hope you're right and that that is exactly what happens, that the damage is done in advance. And then by the time they say, hey, guys, $120 billion a month worth of asset purchases is not sustainable going forward, not necessary, whatever. And then that becomes the moment where you say, okay, risk back on. I hope you're right. And one reason why you might be, Jerome Powell's first full year as a Fed governor was actually 2013. So he had a front row seat for the cadence of that whole plan to go from massive QE to taper to raise rates. He was in the chair, which makes me hopeful that he can stage manage this thing from the lessons that he learned. Yeah. So maybe you'll be right about that, but I agree with you. It is happening now already.
What Rob Sechin, take everybody else's view into perspective. What's your own on where you think the market is going, whether we are going to experience a correction and, you know, maybe a one of some kind of size?
Right. So I think there's going to be volatility in the short term around everything that every investor is looking at. One being interest rates, two being inflation data picking up. There's definitely inflation. Interest rates are definitely going higher. You have a stock market right now that disagrees with the bond market. The stock market is fighting to reposition into cyclicals out of the most widely known names, these high-quality tech names. I'm not saying they're selling them in mass. I'm saying it's modest repositioning, but the effect that has been significant. We're seeing a lot of strange reactions in market data. You can use ETFs as a proxy. The Treasury falls from 175 to 156 in this quarter. Energy leads and financials lead. That is a rotation trade. You're coming out of the technology, which has been one of the worst performers, underperformed the S&P. And I think that has to do with the fact that many forecasters are not as convinced in the power of the reopening trade as the loudest bulls. I would describe myself as one of the more bullish folks in the intermediate term, but very worried in the short term. And I'm going to use any of that short-term volatility to accumulate. We've been calling for a rolling opening of economies globally, and you've seen ebbs and flows. You've seen Brazil open and close, Japan open and close, India open and close. And I think when everything gets open, it's positive for value, it's negative for growth. Stocks are telling you that, and I think the economy looks like a coiled spring ready to jump forward. And I also see that in profits. And one more thing, Scott, if I could make this point. When you look at loan officer surveys, loan officers have relaxed their standards for business lending, and yet loan demand from business is still very weak. What does that tell you? That tells you that the hesitation that these businesses have acts as a coiled spring when they finally believe what's going to happen. And stocks are telling you that, bonds are not.
Yeah, but what if I introduce the idea that the market is also coming around to the idea of higher taxes, both from a personal standpoint and from a corporate standpoint? Yes. Because, I mean, if President Biden gets his way, people are paying more taxes and corporations aren't getting as sweet of a deal as they had for the last 4 years. And you're going to have to rethink what the earnings picture, you know, Courtney, looks like in that new environment. And maybe the market is sniffing that out too, and perhaps more than anything else, that should be the lead story, that the market's not dumb, it's sniffing that out and it doesn't like it.
There's no doubt. Is that a question for me, Scott?
No, it's a question for Courtney.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, a couple of things. One, I think, as Josh said, Jerome Powell in particular, I think he learned from that first full, you know, solo on the stage, and this time around, he does not want to upset the markets. They will be signaling beyond belief. They'll be signaling so strongly that I think a blind person will be able to see it, okay? I have a ton of faith in what the Fed is going to do to make sure that we see an orderly market. That's number one. As it relates to the taxes, regardless of your political views, how you feel about...
Let's stop. Forgive me for interrupting you, but... I don't know about that, right? The market is going to react regardless of whether Jay Powell holds its hand or not. The market, as Josh said,
100%.
Once the market starts to sniff out a taper, there's not going to be anything that Jay Powell and company can do. Unless they just say we're not going
to
taper.
You don't have to sniff it out. You don't have to sniff it out. He's telling you we're going to eventually taper.
No, he's not.
If they are deciding to taper.
That's the point.
Deciding to taper, when they decide to taper, as the economy does better, that should actually signal to the market, regardless of how the market reacts rationally or irrationally. And we've talked about irrational reactions of the market. If they begin to taper, when they begin to raise rates that they've talked about, that means that this economy on a broad scale is doing better. We can talk about the numbers on payroll. We can talk about jobs. It is not as broad of a recovery as we're making it seem. And that is why they're sitting the way that they are right now. There have been tons of very smart economists who have talked about this. And so, Scott, I do believe they will absolutely signal. And I do believe still that the market's going to sit there and say, oh, I didn't know this was going to happen. I agree with you, but it's not going to be long-lived. It's not going to be long-lived by any stretch of the imagination. You should expect it to happen because it always does, but the market will come back to its senses and we will get back to where we should be, which is saying if they begin to do these things, that means that our economy is growing. It will be robust. And I want to get back to your comment, though, about taxes and that growth. I'm not quite sure, and I don't have a crystal ball on Capitol Hill, but I think regardless of party affiliation, there are going to be some people who say, I don't want my taxes to go up. I don't want business taxes to go up because we know what that implies. And I don't believe it actually passes this go round. So mark my word, you can put a stake in the ground here on it. I don't personally think that it actually gets done. If it does, it will be catastrophic.
Okay. Josh Brown, you want to take a stab at that part of the conversation? Because I do think that the prospect of higher taxes is having an impact on the stock market. And it's capping whatever sort of positive feeling may exist in the economy, that this Biden bump for the market, and it's been very much that, is going to be crimped because of his tax plan that may very well get through. Maybe not to the magnitude that he wants at the very top end of his wish list, but Senator Manchin has already signaled that he'd be willing for a compromise of some kind on the corporate tax rate. Maybe it's not going to go
to... A compromise is different than where it is, Scott. Sorry.
Yeah, but it's going up. My point is it's going up from where it is. That means earnings aren't going to be the same.
It's the change in the change rate of change relative to expectations, Scott. So if it comes in at where they present it, that's an absolute negative. But if it comes in less than as presented, if it was political posturing, then it's an unambiguous positive. Also on the taper side of things, in May of 2013, that was the last chance we had to buy before the markets started to rip. They had a little volatility around there, but that was the last chance we had to buy before markets started to go. And I would argue that there is some positioning, some trading going on, to agree with you around taxes, because investors are saying we have 10 years of gains in these high quality tech stocks. If I'm going to do some repositioning, I might as well take it from places where I have the highest gains, because taxes are only going up and it's going to make it infinitely more painful if I wait to make these trades. So I think that's why we're seeing a lot of this strange behavior in markets. It has to do with taxes. It has to do with interest rates, with inflation. I think all that plays into to what we're seeing play out in markets every day.
Let me hit a story before I get to something else. I want to talk about Uber for a moment. I want to do it because it plays into the kind of conversation that we're having in terms of reopening, what's going to happen as we do get on with the rest of our lives, as I've been saying. And now I think we have a real debate, Josh, as to whether Uber is a reopen play or if Uber is a reopen problem. And you have maintained repeatedly that it's a reopened story. And now with wanting to go out to a restaurant rather than maybe get delivery, and now Uber is delivery is becoming a bigger part of that business. A shortage of drivers, higher prices, who knows what the impact is going to be there, the revenue miss. What am I supposed to do with Uber now?
Well, I'm an investor. I'm long. I agree with what Morgan Stanley had to say, that the weakness is buyable. I think it's as simple as the cost of drivers is going up. The cost of everything is going up, by the way. So now we're getting a better look at what happens when there is a bigger labor shortage than what people thought there would be. And you're going to see this in home construction. You're going to see this pretty much everywhere, maybe with the exception of retail. But you're going to see this everywhere. It's tough to find drivers, and they're going to have to pay them more. And in some states, they're going to have to do bigger benefits packages, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's really what was the issue for the stock right now and nothing else. I don't think the growth rate for Uber as the economy reopens is going to be affected. I think the demand is there, and I think it's one of the best ways to play the reopening. Uber, the Uber Eats business, by the way, is not going to shrink back down to its pre-pandemic level for the very obvious reason that you now have tens of millions of people who have tried it and they'll continue to use it. But getting the rides business back to where it was in 2018, 2019, I think can make this stock a rocket higher.
Okay.
And I want to be long the name.
Court, here's what Jim Cramer said today, quote, "I don't know if I respect this business as much as I once did. I think it was great that they moved aggressively into delivery because we didn't want to go to the restaurants. That's over. We want to go to the restaurants more than I've ever seen." This is somebody who owns a couple of restaurants. "People don't want delivery if there's a restaurant nearby." Is Josh dismissing the delivery part of this story too much and the impact on the stock moving forward?
Let me tell you, Scott, and I love Jim, as he knows, but Josh is 100% right. I, too, am a holder of Uber. And when we think about delivery, right, I agree, it is not going back to pre-pandemic levels. And on top of that, when people do want to go to Jim Cramer's restaurant, guess what they're not going to be doing? They're not going to be driving cars every single time. If they want to have a couple of drinks, they're not going to be hailing a taxi home. They're going to be going on that wonderful app on their phone, and they're going to be ordering an Uber. People forget how influential this business and how impactful this business was pre-pandemic. Candidly, during the pandemic, though slowing, it still was alive and well, and how it is going to impact
right,
us
but
post-pandemic.
What if a significant part of its growth side of the business is going to have a different trajectory on the other side of the pandemic? I feel like we're all dismissing that. How are you guys dismissing that?
We're not dismissing it. They have what you want a business to have, which is a diversified revenue stream and brand power, as well as pricing power. We forget that regardless, you know, most people actually that are the bears on this stock point to regulatory issues. They point to the whole issue around rate, you know, drivers getting paid more, et cetera. They have pricing power. Uber has pricing power with the consumer. No one's dismissing it, Scott. It's just it should not overweigh the opportunity that exists with this name. At Loop, we cover it. Rob Sanderson and our team, we have a $69 price target. It absolutely gets there. With delivery and ride hailing, people still say, and unfortunately, even if they're ordering a Lyft, they're saying, hey, I'm going to call an Uber, right? That brand is like many of the other staple brands that we've seen over the last 100 years, and it's not going anywhere at all.
Hey,
and
Judge,
it's going to continue to grow.
When I hear it's a huge mischaracterization of the reality. In the United Kingdom, they had to reclassify drivers, and that mm-hmm. cost them $600 million. Mm-hmm. That's accounting. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that they'll have to do that with all of their drivers worldwide. Nobody on the street thinks that. We've talked about what passed in California becoming a national model for the way drivers are classified. I do think there's going to be this quote unquote third way, which is Dara's proposition. But we have to just understand that a $600 million reduction because of the way that you're classifying the people who are doing the driving, That's not the kind of thing that you should expect to happen every quarter in every geography. So that's now past us. And I think the focus of the street on Uber is going to be how quickly cities and regions reopen and how much growth in rideshare we see as a result of that. And I think that part of the story is bulletproof. We know from the regions of the world that have reopened where Uber has a presence that that demand for rides comes back just as quickly as it disappeared. We know that. So we're going to see that in the United States this summer, and I think it's going to be super bullish.
Okay. Look, before we take a break, I do want to get to a story that is new at noon today and the end of an era, at least the end of one of the most talked about sagas ever on Wall Street. As I reported earlier today, according to sources, Carl Icahn sold the last of his Herbalife position this morning at market, about 5 million shares in a trade I'm told was handled by Jefferies. Icahn had sold a chunk back in January, if you remember. He gave up his board seats, too. Based on my calculations, he made more than $1.3 billion in Herbalife, all told. Famously taking the other side of Bill Ackman's billion-dollar short bet, that led to the infamous brawl on this show back in January of 2013.
If he stays long Herbalife, he will lose his entire investment. That is my prediction.
This could be the mother of all short squeezes.
The war of words between two hedge fund heavyweights is heating up with Carl Icahn bashing Bill Ackman over his short position in Herbalife.
Ackman does pump and dumps. He's got one of the worst reputations on Wall Street. And I'm going to tell you this Herbalife is a classic example of what he does. And I'm telling you, he's like the crybaby in the schoolyard.
Carl Icahn thought, you know what? This guy's roadkill on the hedge fund highway. I'm never going to have to worry about this kid again. He's not going to even have the resources to sue me. This is not an honest guy, and this is not a guy who keeps his word, and this is a guy who takes advantage of little people.
I mean, I wouldn't have an investment with Ackman if you paid me to do it, if Ackman paid me to do it.
He's not used to someone standing up to him. I told Carl after the whole thing, called me up, and he literally said, you know, Bill, we can be friends now. And I simply said to him, I said, look, Carl, you are no friend of mine. And that was it.
I never said that I want to be friends with you, Bill. I wouldn't
okay.
be friends
okay,
with
Carl.
You. And
okay.
I would. You said
okay,
to me you'd like to be friends so that we could invest together.
Carl, I have no interest. Do you think I want to invest with you? Okay, let's move on.
I would invest with you
let's move on.
Last man on earth.
8.5 years ago. I can't believe it's been that long. Carl Icahn has always maintained his belief in Herbalife's business and his activist role in that story. Spoke to him today. He told me the following, quote, I think this is an example of activism working very well. It was certainly an interesting ride, fighting off bear raids as well as aiding the company in their numerous negotiations with the government. But all's well that ends well, and we wish the company the best of luck in the future. As I mentioned, according to my calculations, he made about $1.3 billion. Ackman, he exited back in 2018. We're back after this note. A mystery chart will show you. Restaurant stock doubled in the last year. Bullish call out on it today. Is it too late? Too little? Too late? Courtney owns it. She'll tell you next. And a reminder, you can always watch or listen to us live on the go on the CNBC app. We're back in two.
B2B selling is tougher than ever, and we feel your pain. If you're struggling to close deals, consider giving LinkedIn Sales Navigator a shot. This sales intelligence platform helps professionals like you engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator also guides you in targeting the right buyers, highlights key signals such as job changes or which accounts you should prioritize, and uncovers hidden hot prospects so you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you the most up-to-date first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/halftimereport. That is linkedin.com/halftimereport for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/halftimereport and get started.
Welcome back. I'm Rahel Solomon, and here is your CNBC News update at this hour. A major new report from the United Nations says that cutting methane emissions is critical to slowing climate change. The report says that the oil and gas industry is one of the biggest sources of methane emissions, but that fixing pipeline leaks and other measures could be low-cost solutions. New York's attorney general says that the broadband industry funded millions of fake comments that were submitted in support of the repeal of net neutrality back in 2017. She says that a group called Broadband for America spent over $4 million on the campaign. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signing a new election bill into law. He says that it's meant to stop fraud, but critics say that it will limit voting. Fox News was the only network allowed to cover the signing. The rest of the media had to wait outside. And a pioneer in growing university endowment funds has died. David Swenson was Yale's chief investment officer for more than 35 years. He was an early proponent of schools investing in hedge funds, private equity, and real estate, a strategy that became known as the Yale model and copied by many. David Swenson was 67 years old. You're now up to date. Scott, I'll send it back to you.
All right, we appreciate that, Rahel. Thank you. Well, there's a bullish call today, as we said, in the restaurant space. It was our mystery chart, and it's Darden Restaurants, upgraded to outperform today at Cowen. They say it's fashionably late, but ready for Act Two. Why? The stock's up nearly 20% already this year. Courtney, you own it. So what do you think about this call? Too little, too late?
Oh, gosh. Yes, we'll go with their fashionably late. I talked about this, I think, on the show way back in December when I bought it, and it was a great stock then. It is still a great stock now. I don't believe that it's all priced in. It kind of trailed some of its peers a bit, although it is a market leader on a number of fronts, tremendous management team, data analytics. It's a very, very strong brand. And honestly, here in Atlanta, there was a two-hour wait at Yard House. Two-hour wait. So, you know, I think that there is a tremendous opportunity for growth here, and I'm glad they finally saw that.
Okay. And after the bell, Josh Brown, the Shack, Shake Shack, reports today. After the bell, you, of course, famously own that one. Your expectations for another reopen play that you've certainly spoken a lot about.
Yeah, I like the setup here. The stock's in an 18% drawdown from its highs in mid-March. This is a company that's beaten earnings 75% of the time over the last 8 quarters that they've reported. So pretty good track record of exceeding Wall Street's expectations. It's also one of the best performing restaurant stocks ever. In the last 5 years, it's up 200%. In the last 1 year, it's up 120%. Double the performance of Chipotle. This has just been an absolute home run. So now you have it in a drawdown, and if you don't have a position on, I'm not saying you have to buy ahead of the earnings, but this volatility that's been created in growth stocks, maybe this is your chance for an on-ramp. It's a sub $5 billion market cap with a brand that is globally recognized for quality and deliciousness. And I think it should be a part of anyone's portfolio that is thinking about growth in the future, because I think this company could have thousands of units someday in metropolitan areas all over the world.
Yeah, airports, et cetera. All right, thank you for that. The annual Sohn Investment Conference, it returns next week, featuring some of the biggest names in investing. Impactive Capital's Lauren Taylor Wolf is one of the presenters. She joins us next in a CNBC exclusive.
Old Dominion Freight Line was built on keeping promises. With an industry-leading on-time delivery record and low claims rate, we keep promises better than any other LTL freight carrier, because we treat every shipment like it's our most important one. Visit odfl.com to learn more.
What does it mean to be rich? Maybe it's less about reaching a magic number and more about discovering the magic in life. At Edward Jones, our dedicated financial advisors are the people you can count on for financial strategies that help support a life you love. Because the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Learn more about our comprehensive approach to planning at edwardjones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
Several big name speakers expected at the annual Sohn Investment Conference next week, including Larry Robbins, David Einhorn, Brad Gerstner, and Bill Gurley. Leslie Picker joins us now with Impactive Capital's Lauren Taylor Wolf, who is one of the presenters as well. Hey, Les.
Hey, Scott, that's right. And Lauren, thank you very much for being here ahead of next week's event. Because you so rarely do TV, we rarely get a chance to hear from you. I just wanted to kick things off with you explaining your strategy to the audience, because what you do at Impactive is a little bit different within the activism realm, as well as the ESG, environmental social governance realm. So can you just explain a little bit about your firm?
Sure. Thanks for having me. So Impactive Capital Strategy combines activism with impact, as the name would suggest. But we're different from most of the ESG firms out there, which are passive and inclusion exclusion in nature, or big pools of capital, in that we're only managing 8 to 12 names in our portfolio. And then we are engaging heavily with the management teams of those companies to unlock value with our ideas around both capital allocation ideas, as well as environmental, social, and governance ideas that drive long-term value.
And one of those plays, last time you were at Sohn, you presented on Wyndham, and that was back in 2019, because last year's event was, of course, canceled due to the pandemic. Since then, over the last 2 years, Wyndham has actually risen a relatively respectable 27%. I use the word respectable because obviously we have had a pandemic in there, and many of its peers have done significantly worse than a 27% return over the last 2 years, with the exception of maybe Hilton. That's still, though, half the returns of the S&P 500. And now that the world is kind of changing, reopening, how do you feel about Wyndham at this point in time? Do you still like it?
Sure. So, you know, Wyndham, you know, when we were modeling Wyndham, we did not model in a once-in-a-century global pandemic. But what we did deliberately do was underwrite the resilience of the economy in the mid-scale segment of the model. And when you look at just the financial performance, RevPAR for that segment was down, for the economy segment last year, was down only 30 to 40%, where RevPAR in the upper scale was down closer to 60 to 80%. Just this April, so the last month that was reported for the economy segment, RevPAR was up single digits. And in the mid-scale, it's just 10% below 2019. This compares with down 45% in RevPAR for the upper scale folks like Hilton and Marriott and others. And so we're really very excited about Wyndham, because I can assure you the rest of Wall Street was not expecting the hotel numbers to be back towards 2019 until anywhere near 2023 and 2024. So Wyndham is firing on all cylinders. We're really excited. We believe we got it right with underwriting the economy segment. And just looking from January of 2020 till today, Wyndham has outperformed all the hotel peers by a wide margin.
Now, I have to ask you, because you are an ESG expert, what do you make of what's going on with the electric vehicles trend right now, particularly those who have been acquired by SPACs have seen a significant run up, some significant volatility? Do you see this as an ESG tailwind here? Do you think it's excitement about something else? What do you make of this whole area?
So, listen, I think there are a lot of story stocks. And a lot of these electric vehicle companies or hydrogen companies or green economy and renewable plays have taken advantage of what I would describe as a structure with misaligned incentives to access the capital markets. But what we know about the capital markets and the stock market is that over the long run, it's a weighing machine, not a voting machine. And so I think that similar to the past two SPAC cycles that we saw in 2003 to 2005, and then again in 7 and 8, only 10 or 20% of these companies actually survive in the long run and do well. And I wouldn't expect to be different, this time around.
Wow, that is a bold call. 10 to 20% of these companies survive in the long run. We will keep an eye on that. Lauren Taylor Wolf of Impactive, thank you for joining us. We will be looking forward to hearing your presentation, as well as several others, including Larry Robbins, David Einhorn, and some other folks, Brad Gerstner, who are all speaking at next week's Sohn conference on May 12th. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Scott?
Les, thanks for bringing that to us. We always, of course, as you know, look forward to the Sohn conference. Been proud to have been a part of that for so many years now.
Indeed.
Yep. All right. Leslie Picker with that great interview. All right. Coming up, John has unusual activities. Got three for you today as well, and we'll do it next. All right, Doc, I said you had a threefer for us today, an unusual, which is unusual. What do you have?
Yes, sir. Well, Today, Scott, we're going to kick it off with ANF, Abercrombie and Fitch. Stock was right around the strike price, right around 40, probably 39.80. They were buying the 40 calls that expire the 28th of May. So not a regular expiration, end of May expiration. I bought these calls today, Scott, the at the monies. And if we get a bounce here, I'll sell an upside call against it. Second one, take a look at Taiwan Semi. TSM, of course, the stock was right around 115 bucks a share. They're buying the regular May expiration, 120 calls. And like you said, a third one real quick, Juniper, JNPR. This is a weird strike, the 2673 strike, but they bought about 3,200 calls, bought them really fast, Scott. This also is a May expiration. I am in these calls as well. I'll be in all of these for probably a week to 2 weeks, Scott.
Okay. John, thank you. Up next, increasing diversity when it comes to investing. Market Access CEO Rick McVeigh tells us about his new initiative. You'll hear about it next. Welcome back to the Halftime Report. I am Dominic Chu. We are keeping an eye on shares right now of Wells Fargo, one of America's biggest banks. You can see they're still up 0.75%. However, you can see on that middle side of your screen there a dip of about 50 cents or so intraday in that stock price. This is on the heels of Bloomberg headlines saying that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau may be looking into Wells Fargo over some of its checking account practices. Those particular headlines are what's moving the shares lower right now. We are reaching out to Wells Fargo and the CFPB on these particular headlines. We'll let you know as we hear more back on our end here, but still keep an eye on Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo, a focus. Halftime is back after this commercial break. Keep it right here. Big news in the world of ESG today as the firm Market Access has announced a new initiative to help minority and women and veteran-owned broker-dealers get better access to larger asset managers like BlackRock. Rick McVeigh is the chairman and CEO of Market Access, joins us now live. Welcome. It's good to see you today.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Can you tell me what this means in practical terms for diverse broker-dealers?
Well, it's all about increased trading opportunity for the diversity and minority-owned dealer community. And the unique part about our business model is we've created this wide-open, all-to-all marketplace for global bond trading through open trading that eliminates trading barriers and allows anyone to trade with anyone else. And this is a great way to leverage that network and create new opportunities for the diversity of minority-owned dealers and at the same time add important liquidity to our trading system.
Is that what's been the biggest problem? Is it liquidity? Is it infrastructure? Is it just lack of access? All of the above?
Well, I think the old model does not promote exposing orders more broadly to more dealer firms. The new model at Market Access does. So we're using technology to make it very easy for investment managers to have direct trading relationship with a broader community of dealers. And no better way for them to do that right now than to expand in the diversity and minority-owned firms.
Like Courtney, Loop Capital, right? You're one of the firms involved, and you're also on the board court of Market Access, right?
Absolutely, Scott. It's a tremendous opportunity. I mean, the way that this executive leadership team really collaborated to say, how can we not only be impactful as a part of our diversity initiatives, but also add value to our clients and our shareholders and increase liquidity in the markets more broadly. It's just a tremendous, tremendous initiative that I'm proud to be a part of.
Rick, this would essentially create more liquidity for the bond market itself, correct?
It absolutely does. And that's been our thesis and our model from the beginning. And this is another important step forward to introduce new liquidity into the order flow that we see from global institutional investment managers. And the other new feature to this is that we've unbundled a traditional bond trading revenue into two pieces. So the firms like Courtney's that have full service capabilities and trading can go on trading with institutional clients as they have been. But other firms can participate through post-trade revenue through an unbundled revenue model. So there are two ways to really increase opportunity for the diversity of minority-owned firms.
Well, and institutional players, I assume, want to do this as part of their ESG efforts, which are obviously all the rage these days.
They absolutely do. This is an important priority for them. And the best news is we're making it really easy for them to do. So we've had a great response, as you mentioned, from leading investment manager firms like BlackRock and AllianceBernstein and others. And we think this is just going to be a great initiative for everyone. We're creating more opportunity for dealers and investors, and we're proud to be part of it and use our network in this way.
Yeah. Congratulations on your efforts. I know Courtney's proud of them as well. I didn't even realize only 20% of fixed income trading is done electronically in the industry, which is just an eye-opening stat in and of itself. Rick, appreciate your time very much. Thank you for being here. It's Rick McVey, Market Access. We'll do final trades next. I want to talk about a move that Courtney is making today. Why don't you tell us? I was interested in it when I heard about it. What does it mean?
Yeah, so Scott, I added to my coin position, Coinbase, obviously. We saw a tremendous pullback here. It dropped down to about 272 or so yesterday. And I said this before, and I meant it. I think that this is not only just the leader in the crypto exchange world. I mean, it stores over 11% of cryptocurrency, but it is a customer acquisition story that you can follow, you can measure, and you can watch. And Coinbase is going to continue to lead in this crypto space. And it's a good way to diversify away from Bitcoin and really be able to monetize on all the trading that occurs in the crypto space.
But you don't own Bitcoin itself, correct? This is your crypto play, right?
This is my personal crypto play, and just what I see from institutional investors, both on the asset manager side and asset owner side. I mean, I think we saw today Miami and the county of Miami-Dade made investments in cryptocurrency. So when you start to see just a wide adoption, it's huge.
I got to be real quick. But what's your final trade, Court?
PayPal, down 20%, still tons of room to grow.
All right. Doc?
Uber, bought it during the show, Scott.
Calls?
Yay!
Calls, yep. Bought at the money. Bang!
Okay. Josh?
New highs for JP Morgan. Stock looks tremendous.
Okay. Elvis? I mean,
wanted a touch
Rob?
Of Greg, got a touch of Elvis, Scott. Schlumberger, up 10% quarter to date and room to run.
All right, good stuff. Thanks, everybody. The exchange
Don't
is
do
now.
It yourself.
You've been listening to CNBC's Halftime Report, the podcast. You can always catch us live weekdays at 12 Eastern, only on CNBC.
The spirit of performance defines Acura, and now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura's been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.